When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at MSNBC.com/app.
This week in COVID history, as we end November 2020, President Butterball is for the birds.
I hereby grant you a full heart
victory. We've won the war on Thanksgiving.
Passengers in the United States have set a pandemic air travel record, despite a warning not to travel for the Thanksgiving holiday.
Let's just confine the celebration to the family unit that lives with you.
Stop rocking the gravy boat, Doc.
If you're going to see Grandma for the holidays, it's suddenly a super spreader event.
For many people, this is their final Thanksgiving, believe it or not.
And for some, it's their final Thanksgiving as president.
Today, Wisconsin completed a recount that confirmed Biden's win with a small boost, adding 87 votes.
Ahoy, ahoy, it's the Fox phone. Who's calling at this hour?
Joe Biden did not get 80 million votes. They get dumped. They call them dumps, big, massive dumps.
Speaking of massive dumps,
the conduct of the president's legal team has been a national embarrassment.
Unless the legal situation changes, Joe Biden will be inaugurated on January 20th.
Oh, say it ain't Joe. But Trump remains steadfast, fielding questions from his adorable little desk.
Between you people, don't talk to me that way. You're just a lightweight. Don't talk to me that way. Don't talk to
I'm the president. The president of the United States. Don't talk to me.
This week in COVID history.
Oh, those are so good. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Wednesday, November 24th. Along with Joe, Willie and me, we have the host of Way Too Early and White House Bureau Chief at Politico, Jonathan Lemire. Former aide to the George W. Bush White House and State Department's Elise Jordan is with us this morning. In a moment, we'll have the new reporting on the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack, now subpoenaing the leaders of the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. What kind of information are investigators looking for from those extremist groups? Also yesterday, a jury orders 17 white nationalist leaders and organizations behind the so-called 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, to pay more than $26 million in damages. We'll talk about what that means for those extremist groups. And in a matter of hours, we may know the fate of the three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery. We'll get to that just ahead as well. But first, tensions boiling up between the U.S. and two of its top foreign adversaries. Chinese and Russian officials are condemning U.S. military action near their borders and touting the, quote, unbreakable friendship between the two countries. Coinciding with a virtual meeting between Beijing and Moscow defense leaders yesterday, the Chinese government issued a statement accusing the U.S. of undermining regional stability by recently sailing a guided missile destroyer through the Taiwan Strait. Tensions between China and Taiwan have increased in recent months, with fears China may be plotting an invasion of its neighbor. President Biden last month pledged to support Taiwan in the event of an invasion. As for Russia, Kremlin officials blasted the U.S. for an alleged increase in military advisors and weapons systems near the country's border with Ukraine. This comes as recent satellite images show Russian forces amassing near the Ukraine border, sparking invasion concerns there. Touting China's alliance with Russia, Beijing's defense official said yesterday, quote, standing in the face of frantic U.S. containment and pressure, China and Russia are united together like a great mountain. Our friendship is unbreakable.
It is to laugh. Let's bring in right now President of Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, and columnist and associate editor for The Washington Post, David Ignatius. So Richard Haass, like an unbreakable mountain. I don't even know where to go with that, given the history between China and Russia. But let's talk about the dangers facing the world, the Biden administration, the tough decisions they're going to have to be making. You have two countries that have designs on two different countries, Taiwan and Ukraine, and they both look poised to strike. Could yesterday's meeting, could the joint statement be basically a sign that both may move on their invasions at a time when it'll be hard for the United States to push back?
Look, Joe, we can only measure capabilities. We can't measure intentions. I don't think either is imminent. The China pressure against Taiwan, I think, is longer term. I'm not sure China's yet reached a point where it has all the military capability it would want, need. Russia, though, is very close. If it wanted to launch a massive invasion against Ukraine. Look, these two countries have two things in common. One is their fundamental illiberalism. They are authoritarian, and they really want a very different world order where the kinds of things we're pushing in democracy and human rights don't happen. And then they are in a position, and it gets at this opening thing that Mika just talked about, that they each could potentially benefit from a crisis in the other's backyard, and they might seek to exploit it. So one of the things the Biden administration has to think about is not simply how we deter a crisis in each of these two areas, but also how we prepare for both simultaneously, because I don't think it's possible to rule out a kind of tactical exploitation by Russia or China if there is a crisis elsewhere in the world.
Well, and David Ignatius, that's exactly the concern. I think that many people in the foreign policy field around Joe Biden are having. The fact that we had this joint statement yesterday and you have China ready to go after Taiwan. I've been talking about it, obviously, for decades. And of course, Russia poised to go into Afghanistan. Could they do it simultaneously in a bid to present such an overwhelming challenge to the United States that we cannot respond to either?
I think that's obviously the message they're sending. I see two basic points about this, Joe. The first is alliance mobilization, if you will. And it's always scary when you get these statements of commitment by allies in a period of tension. It reminds us of 1914 and the lead up to World War I, where affirmations of alliances were a key part of the buildup. Russia and China have nominal commitments that were renewed, but this was more specific and graphic language. The thing that worries me more is the way in which these statements seem to suggest an equivalence between Taiwan, which China regards as part of China, that it will someday regain. And the U.S. is committed on paper to the idea that there's one China, although we try to defer when that would ever be resolved. And Russia's view, which Putin stated in a 5,000-word essay last summer that nobody really read, saying that Ukraine is part of Russia. Historically, it's always been part of the Russian homeland. And this equivalence between the two makes me worried that Russia is now putting Ukraine on that same status that Taiwan has been, that we will recover this if not right. This month, next month, if not next month, next year. The forces that Russia has now on the Ukraine border are not seen as sufficient for a full invasion. There are actually fewer today than there were last April, when there was an earlier fear that Russia might go over the border. But they are building. There's intelligence that suggests that Russia has much wider ambitions. So I just would, I'd note this is mobilization, but also it may be putting Ukraine in a different category.
I know Willie's going to get to more on Taiwan in just a moment, but Richard Haass, can I just ask, broadly, do we understand this perhaps as China and Russia sensing U.S. weakness in any way and capitalizing on it?
The short answer is yes. They've seen what's happened over the last few years, whether it was not honoring the so-called red line in Syria under the Obama administration, Then the Trump administration moved away from American allies, abandoned the Kurds in the Middle East. Most recently, you had the Biden administration implementing the Trump administration's exit from Afghanistan. They see the United States in eternal disarray. You know, Joe was talking about this, or David rather, that there's aspects of pre-1914 internationally. Well, if you look at the United States, there's aspects of the 1850s internally. So they see a United States that's divided and distracted. Everybody's talking about Build Back Better or America First. So, yeah, I do think there's a sense of opportunity given that the United States, which for the last three quarters of a century has played this outsized role in the world, that we're no longer prepared to do it. It's simply not a priority for us, and we no longer have the necessary political unity. So, yeah, I do think both Russia and China are intrigued by whether this opens up strategic opportunities for them.
David, there's another layer to this story this morning. The Biden administration has invited Taiwan to its Summit for Democracy next month. 110 countries are included on the State Department's invitation for the virtual event, which aims to help strengthen democracies worldwide. Neither China nor Russia are included on the list. A spokesperson for China's Taiwan Affairs Office said the inclusion of Taiwan was a, quote, mistake. Why is this invite significant, David? We heard further from China yesterday that said the United States needs to deal with China as what it calls one China and not with Taiwan as the self-governing democracy, which you and I know it is.
So the Chinese will be upset by the inclusion of Taiwan in this summit of democracies for two reasons. First, it gives Taiwan a quasi-sovereign status, treating it as one of the nations that will be invited to this conference. And of course, China says, no, Taiwan is part of the nation of China. And the U.S. on paper, at least, continues to recognize that. More fundamentally, this summit of democracies is going to remind the world what is different about Taiwan. I've visited Taiwan. Taiwanese democracy is pretty amazing. That people, especially young Taiwanese, are passionate about the kind of freedom that they have. They're like the kids in Hong Kong. They don't want to live in an authoritarian country. And Chinese look to Taiwan and see this continuing democracy, and it worries Beijing. So it's a significant step. I think one interesting question is whether other countries that are invited, the France's, Germany's, our other democratic friends around the world, will get nervous because the Chinese are really going to turn up the heat on this and will be more wary of Taiwan than the U.S. would like them to be.
You know, and Taiwan is an extraordinary country. I had the opportunity while in Congress to go over to the first inauguration of their first democratically elected president, and was struck by the country, by the business climate, by the culture. It is a strong, vibrant country, Richard. And I do wonder if we are starting to finally see some pushback to the continued bad behavior of President Xi. We've seen him move on Hong Kong, of course. See, the expansion of concentration camps with Uyghurs, the continued militarization of the South China Sea, bombastic rhetoric over the past several months. We have played this fiction with China, that you know, Taiwan is a country whose name shall not be mentioned. And I'm just wondering if the United States is finally starting to push back against this bad behavior, and if President Xi and the rest of leadership in China will soon find out that at some point their abhorrent behavior is going they're going to be held accountable for it.
Well, Joe, there is a consensus that China is acting badly at home and abroad, and we are pushing back. I think the entire strategic orientation of U.S. foreign policy is now moving to counter China. You are seeing greater willingness to come to Taiwan's defense if need be, but I think not as far as you're taking it. We don't see Taiwan as a country. We only see one China. The final status has to be worked out peacefully between the mainland and Taiwan. And we don't want to provoke a crisis. If Taiwan moves in the direction of independence, if it declares independence, if it's recognized as sovereign, I do think that will trigger a conflict. And that would be a conflict
Richard, we don't want to provoke a crisis, but China has been seemingly provoking one crisis after another crisis after another crisis. At some point, the United States needs to respond. I'm wondering whether you think inviting Taiwan to this democracy summit was a good response.
I get uneasy with these. I understand the arguments on that, Joe. It's kind of symbolic. I would much rather the United States increased its ability to come to Taiwan's defense, to deter China from using military force against it, to getting Japan and other countries much more involved in collective defense. I just think we've got to be very careful at reiterating the basics. It's worked for over 40 years now. The three communiques with China, what Nixon and Kissinger negotiated with Zhou Enlai and Mao. And so, yes, we can find expanded space for Taiwan, but we do not want to necessarily push it too far.
Well, and of course, we've been saying, Richard, you and I both have been saying, we have to figure out a way to deal with China, to work with China, to find common grounds, to build a partnership with China, because we're going to be sharing the world stage for the next half century. But that's a two-way street. And at some point, China's going to have to understand that we're going to push back. I guess that's up to people in the Biden administration and smart people like you to figure out the best way, the safest way to push back against their abhorrent behavior, which continues daily. Finally, David Ignatius, I just wanted to take note of a positive sign in the United States Congress. You have the ranking member in the Senate on Foreign Affairs Committee, Senator Risch, actually calling out Republicans that are blocking ambassadorships. We've had a lot of people come on the show complaining that the United States is not represented across the globe and we are far weaker because of it, because our ambassadors are being held up on the Senate floor. But actually, you had Senator Risch, the ranking member, actually speak out and condemn the blockade on diplomatic nominees. A positive sign, isn't it?
Absolutely. Good for Senator Risch. This is overdue, I have to say. This way that both parties, to some extent, have of holding our diplomatic representatives abroad as hostages in what are often very petty domestic political games has got to stop. If I hear one thing from foreign leaders that I talk to, it's the sense of the United States in a period of contraction in terms of its foreign policy, and not having ambassadors in key capitals is part of that. I mean, how are we going to deal with the China problem when we don't have an ambassador there? How can we not have an ambassador in France, in Britain, in key countries with which we have alliances? And people just need to understand, especially senators who ought to be smart enough to get this, that we need our representation in a period where we're being challenged. Without it, we are much more vulnerable to pressure.
Richard Haass and David Ignatius, thank you both very much for being on to talk about these stories this morning as they develop. Moving now to the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, have issued another round of subpoenas. The bipartisan panel is now demanding testimony and documents from leaders of the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and other groups involved in the violence leading up to and on January 6th. Committee Chair Benny Thompson writes in a statement, quote, "We believe the individuals and organizations we subpoenaed today have relevant information about how violence erupted at the Capitol and the preparation leading up to this violent attack." Willie.
Let's bring in senior reporter for NBC News who's been covering this world for so long, Ben Collins. Ben, good morning. Thanks for coming on. So obviously, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, those are broad terms that capture a lot of people. Who exactly are we talking about here with these subpoenas and what's the significance?
Sure. So with the Oath Keepers, it's Stuart Rhodes who's been subpoenaed. So Stuart Rhodes is the head of the Oath Keepers. You know, in the days around January 6th, he was telling people what to bring to the riots to make it look like you don't have weapons, but you do have weapons. He's like, collapsible batons are in a gray area. Bring some flashlights, some D-cell flashlights. They can be used as weapons. You know, he was sort of upset with the president on January 6th because he didn't give enough specific instructions, he thought. And he said, the Patriots are taking it into their own hands here. That's what he said to his followers that day. It, you know, in the run up to that on Telegram and in Discords, these groups specifically thought there would be violence that day and pushed that way. That's in part why Enrique Tarrio, who's the head of the Proud Boys, is also in this batch of subpoenas. Even though Tarrio never made it to D.C., he was brought in on a weapons charge beforehand, arrested on a weapons charge. Tarrio is a really interesting case. He's viewed as a patsy, largely, by the Proud Boys. They believe he's a federal agent because he has worked with the feds in the past. They believe he is some sort of, they believe he's a front for something else within that community. The third most interesting case here is this guy named Robert Patrick Lewis, who works for this group called First Amendment Praetorian, kind of a brand new group from last September, came around, really got kicked up around this whole election fraud conspiracy, was tied to people like Mike Flynn. This guy is a veteran and has, is kind of new to this organizing space, but was really good at it, created a bunch of rallies before January 6th. He has always had this public stance of anti-violence. But on January 6th, it looks like he got swept up. He said, today is the day the true battles begin. So these are groups that were talking about violence either in the run up to the 6th or the 6th itself.
Yeah, and they were pretty explicit about that, as you say. Part of what this committee is looking into, Ben, is any level of coordination between the groups you've just described to us and people in the White House, political leadership, members of Congress, perhaps. To what extent have you seen that in your travels online?
It's really hard to know. There was always this dance with them. With specifically with Rhodes, he said, the president, just as I suspected, isn't going to tell us to go to the Capitol and take it over. He's not going to tell you to do that. But, the president did say, let's all go to the Capitol. Let's all go, hear our voices heard. It's hard to know. These people used, as Rolling Stone reported earlier this week, these people used burner phones to talk to people at the White House. They knew what they were doing was not on the level. It's going to be very hard to unravel this. They always use encrypted communications, whether that's just like things like the Signal app, where they use backends to get around to people that they know they're not doing necessarily great things. So it's a very difficult thing. I don't know how this committee is going to find all this stuff out.
Hey, Ben. Good morning. Jonathan Lemire. Obviously, we're seeing some of the members of these extremist groups be swept up in this, but we know that federal law enforcement still believes they are a threat. And certainly people that I've talked to say that they fear that political violence will be more part of the national discourse, if you will, this midterms and next presidential cycle than perhaps ever before. Give us an update. We hear the occasional news about a rally at the Capitol or a state capitol, and none of that has materialized in anything particularly noteworthy, at least not yet. Give us an update as to where federal law enforcement believes the threat stands from these extremist groups across the nation.
So these threats have largely decentralized in the last few months. They've realized that they can't do this out and about anymore. Even with the Proud Boys Telegram channels, which are sort of the de facto front for these things, the people running those Telegram channels effectively run the movements there. They are not as explicit as they were in the days before the 6th because they didn't think they had, back then they thought they had immunity. Now they don't think they have that anymore. So they are running through, like I said, some encrypted apps. They're doing things that are a little bit more private now than previously. And, these are groups that are ground up groups. They are, they work in these satellite ways. There are Proud Boys groups that are separate from each other on the East Coast and the West Coast. They go from, the Pacific Northwest to California. And then on the East Coast, largely a different group of people, but there is a centralized mission and message there. But in large part, they're to one service, and it's, protecting the people who support Donald Trump in general. And that's their larger goal.
Ben, and I guess to follow up on that a bit, would you say that the movement is stronger today than it was on January 6th? That you actually think that they've gained strength post-insurrection versus having it be diminished with all of the legal that they're going through and the violence that happened on that day?
I definitely believe that's true. I think it's important to note that they will discard leaders willy-nilly. You see people like for example, in Charlottesville at this trial, those people are persona non grata now. People like Chris Cantwell, he's like referred to as the crying Nazi or whatever. Those people are just gone. Richard Spencer, You know, he used to be this thought leader in the white supremacy movement. Now it's, you know, who knows? There's a lot of people don't think he should be around in that space anymore. So they'll get rid of leaders and keep the message and push the message forward. They'll find new heroes, whether those people want to be heroes or not. People like Kyle Rittenhouse, who I'm sure does not want to be the center of the white supremacist movement. They have lionized this man and, you know, created some hero worship around him. They are creating new figures, new caricatures in real time. And they're doing it using these spaces in these, you know, communications that built up over the last 4 or 5 years. It is absolutely larger than ever. It is absolutely more toned to regular American civilians than ever. And that's the difference than 4 or 5 years ago. It's not this fringe thing. They are trying to take over contemporary mainstream politics.
It's frightening. NBC's Ben Collins, thank you so much for your reporting. Thanks for being on this morning. And still ahead on Morning Joe, the man accused of driving his SUV into a crowd at a Wisconsin Christmas parade makes his first court appearance. This as we learn that a sixth victim, an 8-year-old boy, has died in the aftermath of the crash. Plus, three of America's biggest pharmacy chains have been found liable for helping fuel America's opioid crisis. What that decision means for thousands of similar lawsuits across the country. Also ahead, with coronavirus cases on the rise, the Biden administration seeks an emergency order to reinstate its workplace vaccine mandate. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in 3 key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
Hey, welcome back to Morning Joe. Great shot of the Orlando cam, which of course is taken from Mika's penthouse apartment over Magic Kingdom in Orlando.
Look at that traffic,
guys.
No,
the traffic is starting up. By the way, you do ask. So many people will go to Disney and, of course, Universal, the greatest theme park, really, this side of the Comcast Commerce Tree. But the traffic is already picking up out there.
Yeah.
But the weather's so delightful, Willie. But the traffic is so frightful or something like that.
But at least we have it.
But we have it. Exactly. So Willie, wait, what? Any big Thanksgiving plans for you?
Well, I wish I was going to Universal. Now that you mention it, it is the world's greatest theme park. We go constantly.
Really?
My kids,
yes.
We love it there. But we'll be home. We're blessed to have our family very close within driving distance, both sides of our family. So tonight we go to my family in Connecticut, see my parents, my sister, my nephews. And then tomorrow we go out to Jersey for the big feast made by Christina's wonderful mother, Joyce Sharkey, who just puts on a show every holiday season. How about you guys?
That sounds pretty exciting. Mika, what are your Thanksgiving plans?
Well, Willie, I'm in training and it's not going well.
I did eight miles yesterday.
Okay. I did 8 miles yesterday and my time was so bad. I'm going to try and do eight again and 10 over this Thanksgiving weekend, and we'll see how it goes. I'm kind of embarrassed at how slow I am. So that's
well,
on the running side.
You only have to do one big one a week, Mika. So give yourself a smaller couple during the week, like a 3 or a 4. And then on the Saturday or Sunday, then you hit with the 8 or the 10. So you don't want
to
run yourself
into the ground. But I get so mad at myself for being so slow. I feel like I need to do it again, faster. This is not good. But that's, I need to talk to you because I really want to raise money like you did. And I want to beat your time, and it's never going to happen.
Never.
But on top of it, I'll be cooking for Joe and our family, and then I'm going to watch Joe and Jack and the Apples play football.
We have a turkey bowl thing. This is something that happened up in up in Connecticut. Mike Lupica would have turkey bowl, and we would play football. All the parents would get together, play football on Thanksgiving. But it's actually
I'll be jogging around.
Yeah, it's actually though one of Jack's friends is going to have a football game. So I'm very excited about that. And you know, 11, 12 year old comes along. I just got to say, if they come across into my zone, Willie, you know what happens? An old
Stop
Oakland
it.
Raider, forearm
no.
shiver. You'd say, "Is
Jack
my zone?
Tatum.
Stay away." I am. In fact, it's so funny you say that. I got my old Tatum jersey. So
Stop
yeah,
it.
We're going to do that. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure all the kids
it's
are
gonna
as
be wonderful.
Well. It's going to be a wonderful Thanksgiving. Also going to be watching Get Back while reading the lyrics by Paul McCartney. This is a very Beatles Thanksgiving for me. It's about as much fun. I got into the lyrics last night about as much fun as I could imagine having. I'm such a boring guy, I know. Tell us, Elise, about your Thanksgiving
plans.
Baby
girl.
Well, I'm not going to concuss any children like Joe out on the flag football field, but I have not been cooking much at all since I had the baby. So I'm going to make some broccoli casserole and some sweet potato casserole, chest pie. Low-key at home, make some Southern food. Mika, I probably should follow your lead and go for a big run, but probably won't. So we'll see how the cooking goes.
Yeah,
I love
chest
it.
Chest pie.
Oh,
that
with
sounds
your baby
so,
girl.
That's so great. That's such a Southern thing. Let's put some sugar in here, and then we're going to put some more sugar in here.
And some butter.
And then we'll put some butter.
And bless your heart, everybody.
And bless your heart. don't have a heart. That is chest pie. I love it. Jonathan Lemire, you going up to Boston? What are you doing?
No, staying home, just the four of us for Thanksgiving this year. Yeah, it is. Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday. Food, family, football, some helmet to helmet hits in the backyard with my two boys
some targeting.
As well.
I love that.
Yeah, no flags in this league. No penalties. It'll be great. It's also my birthday this weekend, and I'm already getting the present that I want, which is the ability to sleep past 3:15 a few days in a row. So it'll be a good couple of days.
I like that very much. And it is true. There are no
Happy
spearing
birthday.
Penalties in the Lemire's backyard. It's one thing I like about him. Boston born, Boston bred. Very much. Now, let me just ask. I've never been to a Thanksgiving event in Brooklyn. Like, do you wear all black? Like, what's like a Brooklyn hipster Thanksgiving look like?
It's vegan.
Yeah. No, my Thanksgiving is definitely not vegan. You know, Joe, it's a little bit of some hipster traditions, I suppose. We walk around sort of being vaguely disappointed at things. But it's...
I like that.
But we do a much more New England roots, and that is much more true. Yeah. It's much more of a traditional
funny.
Thanksgiving where we fight over cranberry sauce and things like that.
I like it. Vaguely disappointing and walking around saying, we don't deserve good things.
No.
Something we never say in the South or anything we ever used to say as
what
Republicans.
What about Bill Cairns?
Well, we're going to get to Bill in a second. But first, I want to go in because this is so exciting. I asked Alex Gorson, our executive producer, what he was going to be doing for Thanksgiving. And I must say,
Joe,
it was straight out of...
Look
out
at
of
him
a Christmas
along there.
Story.
He's going to be sitting right there?
No, he's not going to a Chinese restaurant for Christmas.
Don't tell people what he's doing.
But he's doing the next best thing. Tell us what you're going to be doing for Thanksgiving, Acorn.
No, our tradition is noon filet mignon Capitol Grill.
Oh, wow.
Must be nice. Wow.
Look at that.
That is good.
He must make the big bucks.
Yeah, he does. Now, that's very, very traditional. I think that's
expensive dinner.
I think that's some of the first Thanksgivings were actually done, little known fact, at Capitol Grill. If you go back,
in the back room.
Capitol Grill's been around in the back.
We don't want to know what TJ's
in
doing, right?
TJ, no. Tell us what you're doing.
I don't think we want to know.
Taking your family out on a sleigh ride with your little
horse. Why wouldn't you want to know? Exciting. No, TJ, we're going to be at home. Know. The boys are home from college, so that's exciting. Which actually is really exciting. Michael Millersville University is marching in the Philadelphia Thanksgiving Day Parade.
So that's exciting. Nice.
Oh, fantastic.
That's great. That's amazing.
Are you going to get out of bed and go and to watch?
No, I'm going to watch it online.
Okay, very good. What a good dad. What a good dad indeed. And finally, Bill Kerins.
Yay.
First of all, we need you to do two things. We need you to tell us what's going to happen Thanksgiving weekend in your house, but also what's going to happen on Thanksgiving Day in the lower 48.
Yeah, you're going to ruin it for us.
That's your forecast for this Thanksgiving weekend. What's the Thanksgiving weekend look like?
Yeah, I'm not going to ruin it for a lot of people. For me, it's a family 5K, a little turkey trot in the morning. Going to make some deviled eggs, some green bean casserole.
Awesome.
Those are my family requirements. And then, you know, 2-hour drive family time. And if I don't want to do the 2-hour drive, I'll just, you know, hop in and join Willie and his family. They're only going to be a couple houses away. So
you're up the street.
Like
that's right.
Oh, nice.
That's right. So let's get into this. They call this the... Yeah, they this is the busiest travel day of the year. It's a cold morning, and that's kind of the worst of it. I mean, if you can deal with the cold, you're fine. That's not going to affect the drive. The airport should be fine. I mean, it's even cold in Florida this morning. We're at 38 in Panama City, 40 in Jacksonville. So, you know, if you can deal with the cold, you'd be okay. It's going to be sunny. Sunglasses needed for all the driving needs east of the Mississippi. There's not a lot of bad weather today, so the airport should be just fine. Maybe minor air delays in Minneapolis, Chicago, Detroit because of the winds. East Coast should be just fine. No issues at all. Thanksgiving Day, we're going to deal with some rain and some thunderstorms. Corpus Christi to Houston. Late in the afternoon, that heads up towards Memphis and also towards the Nashville area. So keep that in mind. And our friends in the Northwest are going to get a lot of rain come Thursday and into Friday. So getting back will be worse than getting to Thanksgiving. We're going to watch a storm system with some snow in northern New England Friday. Then we get another little minor snowstorm on Saturday. And a heads up to anyone trying to return in the Northeast on Sunday. There is a chance that we're going to have a little snowstorm kicking through, especially Sunday night into Monday morning. That could even be the first snow of the season for areas like Philadelphia, New York City, Hartford, and Boston. So we'll keep that in mind for the end of the weekend. But getting to Thanksgiving, guys, looks about as good as it ever has been. So good luck to everyone on the roads and in the air today.
All right, Bill Kerins, thank you very much. And thank you, everybody. Coming up, for all the talk of Joe Biden's struggles, there is a past president who could pave a path forward for him. Is Ronald Reagan the key to Biden's comeback? Morning Joe is back in a moment.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Forty-four past the hour, a live look at the White House there. On this beautiful Wednesday morning, the Biden administration filed an emergency lawsuit yesterday seeking to immediately reinstate the federal vaccine mandate for private employers with 100 or more employees. The Justice Department argued delaying the rule would lead to thousands of hospitalizations and deaths. The mandate triggered numerous lawsuits from Republican-led states as well as religious and business groups. The rule requires workers get vaccinated by January 4th or get tested weekly and wear masks in the workplace. A federal jury in Cleveland has found that CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart substantially contributed to the opioid crisis and overdose deaths in two counties in the state. The jurors concluded that the nation's largest pharmacies did nothing to stop the flood of pills that caused hundreds of overdose deaths in Lake and Trumbull counties. It's the first time pharmacy companies have been held accountable in the opioid crisis that has killed 500,000 Americans over the past two decades. Lawyers for the pharmacy chains will say they will appeal the jury's decision. And the suspect in the Waukesha Christmas parade rampage made his first appearance in court yesterday. As officials confirm, a sixth victim has died, an 8-year-old boy. NBC News correspondent Megan Fitzgerald has the latest.
The man at the center of a horrific tragedy in Waukesha, Wisconsin, appearing before a judge for the first time.
This is case number 21CF.
39-year-old Daryl Brooks charged with five counts of intentional homicide after allegedly plowing through a Christmas parade Sunday evening. And the prosecutor saying more charges are pending after the confirmation of a sixth death, an 8-year-old boy. New images from a doorbell camera a short distance from the parade route appear to show Brooks asking a homeowner to call an Uber.
Can you call it for me, please? I'm homeless.
Not long after, police moving in moments before making an arrest. Court documents show Brooks has a decades-long criminal history, including arrests for sexual abuse, drugs, battery, and domestic violence. Just this month, he was arrested for allegedly running over his child's mother, but was released from jail just days ago after posting a $1,000 bond.
It's clearly a breakdown in the criminal justice system to release a man with his record on a $1,000 bail.
Five dead, ranging from 52 to 81 years old. Three of the victims, Virginia Sorensen, known as Ginny, Leanna Owen, and Tamara Durand, all members of the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies, who marched in Sunday's parade. Wilhelm Hospel died while walking alongside them, carrying cups of ice. Dozens more injured Sunday, including 18 kids rushed to Children's Hospital. 10 remain in ICU while the trauma of that day is setting in.
People screaming everywhere, panic. We just took off running.
Taylor Medrano was at the parade with her 1-year-old son and witnessed the horror.
Could you feel the car zooming past?
It was like a brush of wind. You had all those kids, it was like they weren't even there.
We are all Waukesha.
A devastated community finding comfort in grieving together.
Megan Fitzgerald reporting from Waukesha. The 8-year-old who died yesterday was named Jackson Sparks. He was a member of the Waukesha Blazers Wolfpack baseball team. He was marching with his baseball team. His 12-year-old brother Tucker also was injured. Tucker has been discharged from the hospital. Sadly and tragically, Jackson, though, didn't make it through. There are still children in critical condition. We're sending our love and our prayers to all those families this holiday. The fate of three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery now is in the hands of the jury as deliberations continue today. NBC News correspondent Sam Brock reports from Brunswick, Georgia.
For the family and friends of Ahmaud Arbery, after months of agony, the jury in this case now deliberating.
I do think that we will come back with a guilty verdict. We will get justice for Ahmaud.
At points during the prosecution's rebuttal, graphic photographs of the crime scene causing Ahmaud Arbery's mom to cover her face. Three men in this case face 9 charges, including aggravated assault and murder with malice aforethought, which can be formed in an instant.
It has nothing to do with anger or hatred for a person. Instead, it deals exclusively with the concept of intent. Intent to kill, intent to cause serious bodily harm.
The prosecutor telling the jury a self-defense claim cannot apply when you create the danger and confronts an unarmed victim.
This isn't the Wild West. He moved toward Mr. Arbery with the gun.
a message they hope sticks with the jury.
What's potentially the power of these last 2 hours being the final thing the jury will hear before they start deliberating?
She has a fresh jury. The jury has had all the evidence, and so it's great that right before they go into deliberation, they'll be hearing from the prosecution, making their case, and hopefully getting a conviction.
Throughout the trial, the defense staking its case on a series of neighborhood burglaries. They say the three defendants were trying to peacefully confront a man they believed was at least trespassing.
These are real experiences of real people who were very scared. And so they took it upon themselves to do something about it.
Now, the fates of three men and the families devastated by their actions hanging in the balance.
And joining us now, legal analyst Maya Wiley and Danny Savalos, who you saw in the piece there. Guys, good morning. Good to see you both. Maya, let me begin with you. As the jury sits and we wait, and the defendants wait, and Ahmaud Arbery's family waits for this verdict, just your view of how the case was prosecuted. Many legal analysts that we've been talking to over the last week or so thought prosecutors made the case. What you can't account for is a jury.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, we saw a prosecutor deliver a masterclass and how to prosecute one of these cases, which is to be very clear about the facts, make sure the facts are coming out at trial, but reiterate the points over and over again, as we saw in her closing and in her rebuttal, which was you never heard anyone say Ahmaud Arbery threatened them. You never heard anyone say Ahmaud Arbery committed a crime that they witnessed. You never heard anyone say anything that would give them a reason to make a citizen's arrest or have grounds for self-defense. And then laying out everything that happened in the lead up to the shooting that demonstrated that the defendants actually, frankly, instigated the violence that ended in his death.
So, Danny, Maya just outlined what the prosecution did. Let's have you do what the talk about what the defense did. What was their attempt here to explain what happened? We know that they seemed comfortable with the setting. They didn't ask for a change of venue. They certainly got a jury with 11 out of 12 jurors who are white, perhaps placed their advantage. Walk us through what their argument was.
The entire argument for the defense had to be citizen's arrest. It is the key to the case. If the jury believes that this was a lawful citizen's arrest, it may be a defense to all of the crimes charged. Because if the defense can advance the idea of the totality of the circumstances, yes, it's true. They did not actually see Arbery committing a crime. Yes, it's true. They didn't see him running off of a construction site with material or tools or anything that he stole. But the defense argues that it's not about what they saw. And the jury instruction doesn't require that. Now, there's a huge debate there. And I'm going to say this jury instruction is a ripe ground for appeal because this law, which has since been repealed, as written, was drafted in the 1860s. And it is poorly drafted or was poorly drafted. And an appeals court, if there's a conviction, might look at this and say it was too confusing. The prosecution advanced an interpretation, which is essentially that you have to see or the crime must be committed in your presence to make this citizen's arrest. The defense says, no, it's about the totality of the circumstances. This was a neighborhood that was beset by crime, and therefore tensions were high, and that led to their reasoning for going out and chasing Arbery.
You know, Maya, one of the great, I thought one of the things the defense did really well was they, the prosecution did very well was they kept saying to the jury, you can't claim self-defense if you were the one who caused it put yourself in that position of danger. You can't claim self-defense if you're the one who put yourself in danger and could have avoided it easily. And it seems to me that's something that the jury's going to be grappling with as they go back today. But I thought the prosecution laid it out very clearly.
I completely agree. And I mean, Danny is absolutely right about what the defense was trying to do, which is establish that there wasn't a law violation here because they could make a citizen's arrest. But to your point, what the prosecutor did is remind the jury constantly, 5 minutes, Ahmaud Arbery was avoiding them. He was running. And that they were yelling at him. And remember, they're driving, and this is before the jury, a truck that has a Confederate flag on it. with people who were armed in it, who were screaming at him. And that's, this is the picture that the prosecution is putting out there. And what the jury has to do is say to itself, one, to Danny's point, did they have sufficient grounds to say they believed a crime was being committed? Did they had to actually have seen it or had direct knowledge? And that's the question here that they'll have to decide. But also to your point is how on God's green earth, if he's running for 5 minutes and all he's doing is running, it gives you every opportunity to call the police, to have the police know you can follow him. There's nothing illegal about driving down the street and following him until a cop car shows up. That none of those are the things they did. And the prosecution did something else that was really well done for a prosecutor, which is to demonstrate all their inconsistent statements. Because a big part of what the jury is going to decide is who they believe. So the prosecutor kept saying, really? They didn't say that to the police. They didn't say they were doing a citizen's arrest to the police.
Danny, do you think that the burden has been met here by the prosecution to establish that Arbery was not a threat to these men who shot and killed him?
As in the Rittenhouse case, the prosecution has the burden to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. They also adopted a provocation theory that these men went to the problem and therefore can't claim self-defense. But the key is, and everything Maya said is exactly right, except, well, no. But in addition, I would say that if the jury does find that these men had probable cause, then that Georgia statute, as it was drafted, permitted someone to go out, chase someone, lay their hands on him. These are statutes that date back to the 1860s when there were no police. Citizens were the police. Do we need them today? I don't think so. I don't think it's a good idea.
Again.
Do you trust a lot of citizens to go out and arrest people? I don't. Yes, Joe.
Yeah, probable cause for what?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right. So there, the defense's theory is that there was probable cause to believe that there was a crime. And if it's burglary, a lot of folks say, well, wait, he was just on the property. There was no felony committed. Burglary doesn't require a completed felony. Burglary just requires the entering of the dwelling with the intent to commit a felony therein. And it's not about what he actually did. It's about what the defendants reasonably perceived. And if they didn't reasonably perceive that, they didn't reasonably have probable cause, and their citizen's arrest claim will fail.
Yeah, I just want to make one point here, because Danny's making the right legal points. The defense essentially is that white people were afraid. And I say that because there's also evidence in the record that there were folks who were white who did the exact same thing Ahmaud Arbery did. And yet there was no, let's hop in our car, let's get him, let's trap him like a rat, which is one of the statements made, I think, by Greg McMichael. And that so when I'm hearing the evidence that the defense is posing, and this is why the makeup of the jury matters, what the defense is really doing is saying they had reason to be afraid even though they didn't witness anything. But the reason is because Ahmaud Arbery was a black man. And even one of the lawyers did something that was so blatantly racist, which was to say he had dirty toes, which is actually... One, there was no fact in evidence. Two, completely irrelevant whether he had dirty toes or not.
Well, and of course, don't forget, after Al Sharpton went in there, he started complaining about black preachers and then started talking about fried chicken. And what if Colonel Sanders was on the back row in whiteface? Maya, so there are so many questions to ask coming off of that. But I guess my question is this: what this statute that is causing concern that Danny's bringing up? It reminds me of the open carry law up in Wisconsin. I mean, you have laws that are on the books that, when taken back into jury rooms, can bring back some extraordinarily disturbing decisions by the jury. How important is it for people to get involved in politics on the local level and make sure that these citizen arrest statutes that are
are basically from, you know, from the 1800s and in a bygone era. How important is it that they get changed so jury instructions don't include such antiquated laws?
Yeah, it's critical. And, you know, this is a law that came into existence to enable white people to deputize themselves to return black people to slavery. That's the history of this law. And frankly, the history of slavery is part of why we have had a growth in permitting these kinds of rampant self-defense cases. So we do need people to get actively engaged, but also to educate themselves what the origins of these laws are and what actually keeps us safe, because these are not laws that are keeping any of us safe.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.